I wanted to begin today's podcast with a bit of a disclaimer. We talked about a very difficult topic today in class. It's one that I think you'll really enjoy and cause you to think. The challenge is that we talked about how in the early century of the church, during the 19th century, the 1800s, that the brethren saw many doctrines differently than the way that we see them now. They had rudimentary knowledge and understanding, but since then we have had decades of additional light and knowledge and revelation that clarified the things that they believed back then. Because of that, some of the things that they taught and some of the procedures in the temple and elsewhere may look a little confusing to us now, because we have the light of spiritual 2020 in our current day. So as you listen to today's class, recognize that much of what we're talking about was what they believed back in the 1800s and has since been clarified and updated and moved forward in a way that we understand those doctrines differently now than we did back then. These are deep in doctrine. You might have to listen to this a couple of times to get it down, but I think it's essential to understand how they saw things then, how we see things now, so that we don't get pulled into attacks on what the church believed or believes based on the things that were taught and believed back then. These are important issues, and recognize at the end of the day, the gospel roots are deep and strong, and that our understanding of the light and knowledge that we have is so much greater than it was back then. So, listen to it with a little bit of a disclaimer and enjoy. Interesting class, and well done by the class in sorting through all of these issues. Thanks. Let's go ahead and get started today. This is going to be kind of a fun couple of weeks here. And I want to preface the next couple of weeks with this. Last semester, we kind of waded through some heavy doctrinal stuff, church historically wise. And one of the things that we landed on late last semester was the 1978 revelation on the priesthood ban, or the restoration of putting it back where it was before it went south. But one of the things that I think we learned last semester was a couple of things. And one was, I believe that we're blessed to be part of a church that's firmly grounded in truth, and we have a rich history and a rich tradition. Our roots are deep. And so we want to have this history, and we want to have the tradition. And we balance that a little bit about the fact that we also believe in eternal growth and progression. We have our roots, but we also have the upper branches that are sprouting and things like that. And so on top of that, then, we have leaders and members are mortal, and they're still learning. I was thinking about this earlier. When I was growing up in Utah, we had our house that we lived in for quite a while had a carport next to the house. And then next to the carport was this set of rose bushes that were my mom's pride and joy. She loved her rose bushes. And we had this cycle that would happen every single year. And that is, somewhere in the early spring, right after the snows had kind of gone away, my dad would go in. He'd grown up on a farm. And he'd just prune the heck out of these rose bushes. He'd just take them right down to the ground. And so they're just a bunch of little stump things. And my mom would come out, and I clearly remember her on numerous springs going, "Arlo, what have you done to my roses? You know, they're just all cut down." And he'd say, "No, they'll come back. No, look, they're not going to come back from this." And she'd always be upset about that and everything. And then by early summer, it was blooming and everything. And by late summer, it was almost pushing its way into the carport, where we couldn't get the car parked because the roses were all over the place. And my mom was loving the roses that we had all summer, and then it would be winter, and then it would be spring, and then Dad would go out with his clippers and chop them down again. And yeah, and she was just, and she just, it just bothered, you know, don't cut them that far. And he goes, no, can't you, I just trim a little bit. And he goes, no, it needs to really be pruned. And I realized that if you think about the, like the Jacob 5 and the parable of the olive tree and stuff like that, they're always pruning. They're always part of preparing and getting the fruit ready is pruning. They're cutting things out so that new shoots can come in, but and they can do that because the roots are really deep and firm and everything, and so you need to get rid of the stray things, okay? Does that make sense? You see where I'm going with this? All right, because this week and next week we're going to talk about pruning in the church, because we're going to talk about a couple of kind of twin major prunings that are going to happen in the late 1800s in the church, and one is going to be the principle of adoption, and the other one's going to be polygamy. You know, the Republicans had the twin barbs of or the twin barb of that doesn't sound, the barbs of barbarism, the twin relics of barbarism. Yes, slavery and polygamy, and we're going to have the couple of places the church needed to be pruned, but they were products of that period of time. But can we keep an eye firmly on the idea that because our roots are so grounded, and that we believe that the church and us, we're on a path of eternal progression. We are always progressing, knowledge wise, growth wise. We're always progressing, and so in the midst of that, we're watching leaders that are mortal and still growing. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Well, that said, one of the things that I've stumbled across that I really like, part of what happened that we were able to do last year is that we were able to kind of dive through the Joseph Smith paper project that has all this rich stuff, and you can read the original documents and you see the commentary and the history that accompanies the Joseph Smith paper project. Well, on a much smaller scale, there's a couple of other ones that are going out. My son's father-in-law is working on the Hiram Smith papers. But there's another group, and descendants actually of Wilford Woodruff are spearheading this with the church's help and blessing, the Wilford Woodruff Papers Project. And one of the things we know about Wilford Woodruff is that he was a very detailed journal writer for 64 years. And so a lot of what's happening in Nauvoo and then in Great Britain and then in Salt Lake and all that, we have his daily journal, and then as a prophet, we have his writing. So that he becomes a really great chronicler of what's going on out there. 64 years. And so you don't always necessarily recognize it, but this is really, really true because of what he was involved in with Brigham Young, and because of Brigham Young's other responsibilities. He is perhaps the most influential architect of temple worship and ordinances that we've ever had in the church. He was there in Nauvoo. He helped shape it with Brigham Young. Then as we come out, then he's really involved in helping as they start establishing it. Because, for instance, when the temple endowment is first given in the red brick store, it's oral. Joseph Smith is just talking kind of off the top of his head and what he believes. He's teaching them, but it's not written down. So you can't have like a temple worker that's going to come in and read how the endowment is supposed to go. That doesn't happen until 1846, and that's Wilford Woodruff working with Brigham Young. He's writing it down, framing it, the analogies, how they're using it, how they're going to draw on Masonic symbols and things like that. They're the ones that are actually categorizing it, everything that's going to happen with that. Yeah. At what point does it become canon? Where is it canon? The endowment session? The endowment itself? That's an interesting thought.
Maybe the principles are, but the words sure aren't. They're not like they're dictated from God.
Right. And that's why that's going to be an important distinction. There are principles that are involved in that, because
about 40% of the endowment is letter for letter quotes out of the scriptures.
Yeah, yeah. But then the way that we frame it and the things that we use around it are like, oh, no, these are, how do we teach these principles? Because at the end of the day, we're going to send you to the temple, and now you're going to learn about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And you go to the temple and go, there wasn't very many principles I didn't know before I went to the temple. But now I've taken those principles and I've made covenants and promises, and I participated in ordinances that are critical. But in terms of the actual knowledge, if you just look at, like you say, it's out of the scriptures, it's there.
And if you look in the old gospel principles manual, the first 11 chapters are about a third or a half of the endowment.
Yeah. So it's interesting to talk about canon. So, because hold on to that idea, because we have an idea. Like, for instance, if I say to Baptists and Sola Scriptura, and they're going to say, what is canon? It is what? It's the Bible. And you don't mess with the Bible. You don't change the Bible. It's carved in stone. And if it's not in the Bible, it's not true. And it's just all there. And we have a tendency sometimes to try and do that with the gospel, but if we're going backwards, we recognize this is a church of progression that has deep roots, and we prune when needed as we get light and knowledge. Yeah.
Well, it's like the proclamation on the family is not canon.
No.
Because we have an open canon, you know, and once you start canonizing stuff, you freeze it.
Yeah.
Well, anybody that would want that canonized would want gospel doctrine by Bruce Armstrong.
I know. You know, in the next couple of months, we're about to do an interesting dance in the church, and that is that when we get to Come Follow Me, what happens when we get to section 132 on polygamy and plural marriage, stuff like that? You're going to watch a lot of tap dancing going on. It's like there are some parts of section 32 that we really like, and some parts we're not, you don't hear quoted in general conference, you know, and section 132 wasn't even added until 1880, you know? Yeah. And so once we nail those down, now you have a harder time. So the idea of open canon gives us more space, I think. Now for those that are really kind of more fundamentally driven, they would like the family proclamation. They would like every general conference talk canonized and nail it down, and are kind of upset a bit that sometimes, you know, that maybe we're changing some of the words of Ezra Taft Benson or something like that, and go, no, that's not how it works. Yeah.
I teach an institute class too. This year we're studying Jesus the Christ, and in the process this summer of kind of getting ready for that, I was studying the life of Elder Talmage. And I think it's really interesting just deciding what's canon and what's not.
Yeah.
At one point, the First Presidency asked him to publish like a condensed version of the Doctrine and Covenants that would be cheaper to print and that would be utilized. He went through and decided there were some sections that were really helpful and applicable, and there were some that were not. And interestingly enough, he took out 95 sections of the Doctrine and Covenants in his condensed form that he felt like had no bill
hearing,
and section 132
was one of those. That's interesting. I did not know that.
95 sections.
Okay. Well, I look at, okay. Yes. Yes.
Well, I look at how many people are willing to contend with each other about points of doctrine that haven't been revealed to the church. You know, but maybe I've pondered and prayed about it, and I understand it, and you've pondered and prayed about it, and you understand it, and we both misunderstand it differently, and we're willing to
That's a good way to put it.
We're willing to fight about it.
Yeah.
And the gospel is the gospel of Jesus Christ and repentance.
Yeah.
And if you if you got stuck with just those two things, you'd be good enough.
Yeah, I know. Except that we like our little point of view, and of course I'm right and you're wrong.
Oh, yeah.
yet reveal. Well, because when we update and when we prune, then there's a significant part of the church that really struggles with the fact that that's not how David O. McKay did it, and that's not how Ezra Taft Benson did it, and that's not how Joseph Fielding Smith said that this was.
We don't have a catechism. I mean, Bruce R. McConkie tried to write it.
Yes, he did.
And the Brit, it didn't set well with the Brit.
No.
And then it was many, many corrections, and it was republished and then taken out of print. And it's not that it's not a great reference book.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we don't want to say Mormon doctrine. That can change all the time.
Kind of imperfect.
It's a little bit imperfect.
So that when they change the endowment, some people think that all the changes are new revelation. A lot of those changes are because the culture of the people who are attending has changed, and it's been massaged to speak to their cultural background.
Yeah, and in fact, hang on, because that's really where we're going. But because when we get now to so it makes sense in the early church when we build the first temple after Nauvoo, the first one that's completed is going to be St. George, and it makes sense that Wilford Woodruff would be the president of that temple, because now we're going to, how do we really organize a temple? Because what's going to happen in St. George is different than what was happening in Nauvoo, and certainly different from what was happening in Kirtland. It's shifting because it's being reframed, it's being organized, and Wilford Woodruff is behind this. And so that's why, jumping ahead, in the 1894 General Conference, he's going to stand up and he's going to say, "We have had prophets and apostles. President Young, who followed President Joseph Smith, led us here. He organized these temples. He carried out the purposes of his calling in office. He laid the foundation of this great temple on this block, as well as others in the mountains of Israel. What for? That we may carry out these principles of redemption for the dead. He accomplished all that God required at his hands." And then he says this. This is kind of where we're going. "But he did not receive all the revelations that belong to this work. Neither did President Taylor, nor has Wilford Woodruff. There will be no end to this work until it's perfected." This is Wilford Woodruff. This is the talk in which he's going to explain a revelation that he's received that changes the temple ordinance after 50 years in some very dramatic ways. And that's what I want to talk about today. Okay. So let's back up a little bit. And the only way that I could really explain this is to kind of go down this road. And I'm going to use Queen Elizabeth on this. We could do it for King Charles, but Queen Elizabeth. Now, think about what has to happen. If you're going to have royalty, and we've talked about before that in the Christian tradition, in the British tradition, the monarch is she is the heir and successor of who? Closer. King David. Okay. In other words, in kind of this succession understanding of things, that when the Jewish nation killed Christ, they had abdicated their throne as the chosen people. So actually now the Christian nation is the new chosen people. And so the king or queen of the Christian nation, we're going to bypass the Pope, kind of thing, okay, is going to be holding the throne of David. We talked about, and it sits right here, okay?
The stone of Scoon.
The stone of Scoon is supposed to be the pillar that Jacob erected in the wilderness at Peniel to say, I'm going to put up a monument here. And this stone of Scoon the king that in Braveheart that attacks the I remember his name in me. Anyway, he goes up to Scotland. It was sitting in Scotland. They stole it. They took it back to England. And then about 20 years ago, they gave it back to Scotland. But all of the monarchs up to that point had been coronated on the Stone of Scone. Yeah, it was. So it's King Richard, not Lionhearted.
So is this vision that Jacob had, was this when he was on his way to Laban's house? Or, before he got married?
Yeah. So, but anyway, we're tying back to the Jewish kings, right? So now, could anybody in England, if the monarch's going to die, can anybody in England assume the throne? No. You've got to have, first of all, in order to be a possible successor to the throne, there are two dual lineages that have to come into play. Number one, there's a genetic lineage. You have to be able to prove father to son to father to son or to daughter, stuff like that, in an unbroken lineage back to be able to claim as an heir, as a possibility. You're not a king yet, but you are not yet appointed to become such. I'm using that language deliberately. Okay. Okay. Was that?
I didn't even know.
Okay. I didn't think you did. Okay. So you got to be an heir and you got to be able to prove that genetically. Okay. Because not everybody can be that. Okay. Now, at a certain point, though, like the death of the prior monarch, now you can't just step in and become the king or the queen. There is a second lineage that has to kick in, and it would be what?
Don't you have to kill all your brothers and
Well, that would be one way to do it. Eliminate the competition. You have to be ordained by a priesthood lineage. And it's a priesthood lineage that you have to be able to track back under the hands of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Yeah, to Aaron. You've got to be able to go back. So when she is anointed, and in the movie... The crown that they show it actually pretty well. She's being anointed with oil. Anybody know where that oil comes from? Bethlehem. It's got to be coming from the Holy Land because we're actually tracking back so that under priesthood lineage, if you can connect to that lineage, now you're able to then place that on somebody that has a genetic lineage, and that person gets to be set apart. Now, can you do that just anywhere? No. In fact, if you haven't ever watched The Crown, this you need to watch because it ought to be really fascinating for members of the church because it has to be done in a set apart place away from the eyes of anybody to see. So she will then go back in. They will pull that down. The Archbishop inside that canopy will go ahead and anoint her with this oil from Bethlehem before she then emerges from the Holy of Holies, and now she's now the monarch. Okay, that makes sense? Yeah, it does. We're going to go back into this private place, and again, it's an idea that this is called supersessionism. This means at this moment, this person is now the prophet, if you will, that was the heir, received the priesthood, and now we move forward. Okay? Now, got that idea, the two dual lineages? Okay. So what's going to happen here in 19th century, 1800, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's the rightful heir. The Pope has gone astray. Yeah. Yeah, well, depends on who you talk to. Okay. So we need so there was this understanding then. And I jump ahead. So here was the understanding of the members of the church in the early 1800s into the late 1800s. Okay. And that was that there had been a priesthood conferred upon Adam. Okay. That Adam had conferred that upon Abraham. Now, Abraham is interesting because Abraham's going to be given a whole set of blessings, but he now gets the priesthood. That's going to then go to Jacob, and from Jacob to the Israel, 12 tribes, right? And that all of that was going to then be present then in Joseph Smith. We'll talk about how Joseph Smith gets this, okay? So... Yeah, that's one of the reasons why in the scriptures you see these lineage, that they're very careful about the provenance of.
Well, they don't have Enoch or Noah.
Well, they do. They do. But yeah.
Adam was the direct guy that gave it to Abraham.
Yeah. Yeah. Father to son to father to son, and it has to be unbroken. But we'll talk about what happens right here. This is where. So Joseph Smith, you know, we kind of laughed a lot about the fact that. That early church was more of an Old Testament church than it was a Christian church. It was, and this is the reason why, guys, is that Joseph felt that he was now holding the priesthood and responsibilities of Abraham and Adam, and that he had been given a specific calling to gather in scattered Israel. That the salvation, in a weird sort of way, salvation is only coming to one family, Israel.
I was thinking this is kind of explaining to me that it came up when Joseph died.
Yes.
And who should be the next
prophet? How does that work?
So it's not following the way it has historically. We break off and now do something.
This would be Emma Smith's contention. That it shouldn't go to the 12, it should go to her son. That's exactly what they argued. Okay? But Joseph felt like his job was to gather in scattered Israel to save them. They've got to be found, they've been scattered, we've got to bring them back. Okay? Because there was going to be an eternal increase that would then come in. So not just the priesthood, but it's now in the eternities, and it's an increase that Abraham was promised that through him all the nations of the world would be blessed. But we're only blessing Israel. So in a very literal, how do we do this? How does this work? Ah, well, there is some doctrinal dancing that goes along with this. In that Joseph felt like he was now the holder of the priesthood, but he was responsible for the blessings of Abraham, and how do we give the blessings of Abraham to scattered Israel? Well, watch how this progresses, okay? So the way they're going to look, they're seeing there's two lineages. One, you've got to be, if you're going to be blessed and you're going to be saved, you've got to come from a literal lineage of Israel, okay? Now, here's how that worked. The first written references to adoption. So now, whether you're in Israel or not, we need to get you adopted into the house of Israel so you can get all the blessings. So the first references to adoption into the kingdom of God by baptism. Baptism, the way it's going to be framed is by baptism. We're made by Parley Pratt. In his 1837 publication in Great Britain, A Voice of Warning, Parley gives an example of the Christ's apostles who were expected to, quote, unlock the door of the kingdom and to adopt strangers and foreigners into it as legal citizens by administering certain laws and ordinances. If you're Israel, how do I bring you in to Israel? How do I bring you back so you can be an heir? The key is baptism. That's what baptism is supposed to do. Baptism, he indicated that converts will be gathered out and adopted into the house of Israel, whether you're Gentile or not, and be partakers of the same covenant of promise. Joseph Smith explained, as Paul had written, that only through baptism, listen close, only through baptism can we legally call God our Father and approach him with the confidence of sons and children of the highest. That early understanding that Joseph had and that the brethren had was that until you are baptized, you're not necessarily children of God. But the minute that I get you into baptism, now you're heir to the kingdom. But we got to get you baptized first. That's why baptism becomes so important. So in one sense, it's like, yes, it's for remission of sins. But even more importantly, you're now going to be, by baptism, you become Israel. That heavy? Yes. Well, that's a good way to put it. I'm going to become a new son and daughter of Christ, but that means that I have a new father. Now I'm being adopted in into that lineage. Yeah. Yeah, because you're not, because you haven't been baptized in yet. Okay, all right. That's why. That's yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could be, but you're not considered this a full son and child of the highest, with all the blessings that are available to you until you've been baptized in. It's like, you're not until I adopt you into my family do you get my blessings. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Hold on. Let me say again. This was the thinking in the first few decades of the church. And we have since pruned some of these things out. But I want you to see that the way that they thought still influences the way that we see some things in the church. Because you're exactly right, and that's exactly what you would hear over the pulpit today. You wouldn't necessarily hear that in 1843, okay? Because their understanding was different.
I'm just
going to
bring up
this. No. No.
You're saying that it's not even doctrine anymore?
Watch what they did with it. Hold on. I know. Remember when I go back and said, you know what? This church has grown and it gets pruned from time to time. I can't emphasize that enough. Yeah. Okay. All right. She's like, oh man. Okay. That is why in this September 6, 1842 letter to the church, Joseph Smith taught that the living, and I'll show you the quote in a sec, Joseph taught that the living would be connected or sealed to their ancestral fathers by baptism. Baptism was the sealing in 1842. Okay? Thus adopting them into the family and kingdom of God. Okay? In other words, you can't get all the blessings unless you're an heir. So I got to make you an heir. I got to have you adopted into the family so you get to the reading of the will, that you get your part of the inheritance. You don't give the inheritance to somebody who's not a member of the family. And baptism is the way. Okay? But wait, there's more. Okay? So this September 9th, 1842 understanding. Consequently, the baptismal font was instituted as similitude of the grave, and commanded to be a place where the living are wont to go to assemble the living and the dead, that all things may have their likeness, as Joseph Smith talking, when he's talking about the importance of, instead of baptizing people in the river for the dead, we're going to build, and this is actually the drawing for the original wooden baptismal font for the Nauvoo Temple. Okay, we need this thing carved because we need to have a baptismal font so we can do baptisms for the dead, no longer in the river. Needs to be here. And they built like a little covering over the top. So even while the footings and the walls were slowly coming up in the temple, they had built this little shack over the top of the baptismal font, and they were doing baptism for the dead there. Because this is big. We gotta make our family, we gotta have our families be heir. They're still outside. They're outside the reading of the will. We gotta get them in here. I think so, yeah. I think they probably were, because it was men for women, and mother, the very first one's a mother for her boy, and so there was, yeah, that needed to change. But this is Joseph Smith in 18. The baptism?
Yeah, baptism in the river. And more people were doing all of these.
No, they believe that was actually, now they're going to become a new creature. They got the baptism. But even more importantly, now as a result of the baptism, now they're a member of the house of Israel. Now they're a new creature with a new genealogy, and a new genealogy that goes back to Jacob.
But they were not effective.
Yeah, it had to be redone because it wasn't done right. And it wasn't recorded. I mean, there was a lot of things. And Joseph sad to say, there's a lot of things that weren't right about this. So they were kind of going back and cleaning it up. And they did a lot of that too in the St. George Temple. Let's make sure we get this done right. Yeah.
So according to the Revelation, the baptisms were capable of being valid, but they weren't all valid, but they weren't going to continue to be valid unless they converted over to doing them in a proper font. Yeah. So there would have been baptisms that were done before this that were valid. But many of them would still end up getting redone for administrative purposes.
So we got it recorded. Yeah. Okay. Now listen to the next part. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Rick.
How does this concept, how is it applicable to children under the age of 8 who weren't baptized? How did they become?
Right. Hold on to that. Because they accounted for that. They really did. Again, if in some ways, it's a little bit like, again, if you're a Christian and you believe that the Bible is sola scriptura, and then you're going to get something like the creation of the world or the flood, you have to kind of paint yourself into a corner. You got to dance a little bit to kind of, in that literalism, you got to come up with, you know. And there was a certain amount of this. When they painted themselves into this corner, they had to get a path out. And that's when
if they had evidence that the child died before the age of 8, then they wouldn't have to do it. But if they didn't know how old the child was when he died, it wasn't considered like a sin to baptize and then later find out the kid was only 6.
Hold on. But remember, you're thinking now.
Right.
Let me show you what they did. Because again, they're going to account for it. Okay. Now, but in as far as September 1842, Joseph Smith is saying this baptism for the dead, this is the sealing and binding power. That's it. When we have, in one sense of the word, the keys of the kingdom, which consists of the key of knowledge. At the moment that we have been baptized, you've been baptized for your ancestor, you are now sealed to them. All the power of Elijah is there. You did the baptism. Done. Finished. Got it. That's,
other than done, finished, and got it, I mean, there's some truth to it.
Well, there is.
You give them access to the celestial kingdom. And so.
But you still don't get the celestial, but that was the understanding in 1842. Now watch what happens. Okay? Because again, for Joseph, everything was this unfolding process, and he was learning step by step as more light and knowledge came, as it will come to Wilford Woodruff. Okay? Now, you're going to be heirs on both sides of the veil, March 10th, 1844. So this is 2 years later. By March 10th, 1844, Wilford recorded that in one of the most important and interesting subjects ever presented to the saints, on this occasion, Joseph Smith explained that the spirit and power of the Elijah to the saints. He told them, holding the keys of the Melchizedek priesthood that he got from Adam to Abraham, all the way down to Peter, James, and John, and now he can give them the Melchizedek priesthood. They would receive and perform all the ordinances belonging to the kingdom of God. Now, up to this point, it had just been baptism. Now, what's happened by spring of 1844? What's been happening over the last year? The temple endowment that's taking place in the red brick store. And he is now administering the washing anointings, all of the stuff, the initiatory. It's all happening in the red brick store. All the stuff which it turned out that baptism was the one pillar, the air, but now we need the other side, the other pillar, which is going to be the priesthood ceiling. Okay? And look where he goes. Okay? In response to the question, what is this office and work of Elijah? Joseph stated it's one of the most important subjects that God has ever revealed. He then said to the saints, go and seal on earth your sons and daughters unto yourself and yourself the fathers in eternal glory. And what he's now talking about, they are now starting to perform sealings, and he's marrying people. So now suddenly marriage, and then what do we do about the kids? Well, we're now going to have the kids sealed to us. The idea of being born under the covenant was really not there yet. So literally, if you've got kids, they're going to be sealed to you. And it's only going to become under Wilford Woodruff that says, if you guys were married in the temple and your kids are born, we don't have to necessarily seal them to you in a separate deal. That's not going to come. Sealing was the next step up from baptism. In other words, we got to have both. But you're right. For a kid, they wouldn't necessarily need to be baptized because now they're your lineage. If you're in, they're in. They're born to you. It's an heir. Yeah.
So first it was baptism.
Yeah.
Seals everyone.
Right. But that's baptism, the heirship.
The baptism doesn't have to be done by the Melchizedek.
But back then.
Back then it did.
Yeah. It's one of those things that has refined itself a bit. Okay. But when he's talking about holding the keys of the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood, that's more than just baptism, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that would be, now we're talking about sealings. And so hold on. Okay. How are we doing so far? Is this fun?
Wow.
We doing some swimming? Okay. This is what I've been doing for the last week. I've been swimming because as I'm putting all this together, reading through this, I learned a lot this week. Yeah. Yes.
You have to really understand, because you could talk to many good other people in other churches, but I make those types of commitments all the time.
Yeah, I know.
And then, but our challenge is, but it needs to be done by the temple. That's the difference.
Yeah, and I need you to see how that came from, how it was framed. See, in 2 short years, Joseph had progressed from teaching that baptism was sufficient to bind the fathers and children together to learning that it was possible to seal individuals to each other on both sides of the veil, but that would require a sealing ceremony after you had come in as an heir. Baptism, now you needed an additional thing. Okay?
Isn't this called kingdom theology?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And watch where it goes from here. It just gets more fun. Okay, so now we have, yeah?
So, it is line upon line, but then there's also the us jumping ahead, which, for instance, when he first taught baptism, people ran down to the creek and started baptizing, and And then we ourselves have had, you know, there was a time when people had their second anointing or they're calling an election.
Hold on to that.
When it was common, when the state president could give you a recommend to do that.
To finish it up.
And people would go and say, hey, can I do this? And they'd say, sure.
Yep.
And that, so sometimes we back up when we've maybe gone further than we understand.
And that's really kind of the important point. We've gone farther than we understand. So sometimes in our going forward, we're going to have to come back and get it right. Yeah, they were after it, weren't they? Yeah. Yeah. And in a literal, the thing about literalism and being literal is there's also, I want certainty. In symbolism, there's a variety of ways we could look at this as an allegory. But one of the things that is so important to so many Christians is I let Christ in my life. I am now a Christian. I'm done. I made it. I'm sure that I'm making it. And I want that surety. And I don't want to be told that I could lose that. I'm going to lock onto my surety. In literalism, they wanted to know that, well, look, they want to make sure you're not linked to the wrong person. That's there's a problem here, okay? So here's DNC 84. When they start looking, okay, now I got the heirship, I have the lineage, but now I need to have the priesthood power, and so that's the other wing here. For whoso is faithful to obtaining these two priesthoods of which I've spoken, magnify their calling, sanctified by the Spirit and the renewing of their body. Okay, I'm being changed. Okay, now, they become literally the sons of Moses and Aaron and the seed of Abraham and the church and the kingdom and elect of God. If you get this priesthood, now you have a direct lineage on the priesthood side, on the ordination side. I couldn't get it till I got baptized, but now I got this. Now I've combine the two together, and I could literally trace my lineage back to Moses, but I can also trace my priesthood back to Moses, and I become a son of Moses and Aaron. Okay? That's surety. You go, girl.
So is this what polyandry
is? Yes. Yeah. Yep. We're after lineage.
Yeah.
That, and herein lies the problem. So Joseph Smith is going to see himself, and he's going to say, Wilford Woodruff explained to the saints that Joseph Smith, through the loins of ancient Joseph, remember, he is, the Book of Mormon says he was of the lineage. So Joseph really, because he was already this ancestral heir coming back to Joseph, through Joseph to Jacob, and then Jacob to Abraham and all that, okay? Now, as his literal descendant was heir to the priesthood keys by birthright through Joseph, the birthright son, and Joseph by birthright. So when Joseph was adopted into the priesthood line by virtue of his ordination to the Melchizedek priesthood by Peter, James, and John, he bridged the gap between the dispensations when apostasy occurred and the priesthood was taken from the earth. See, the problem with the priesthood thing is that when we talk about the great apostasy, the way that they viewed the great apostasy was the fact that the priesthood was lost. The apostles died, there was no priesthood. So now there's this period of time where there's no priesthood out there. Even though you might have lineage people coming through here, there's no priesthood lineage. So when Peter, James, and John come and ordain Joseph and Oliver, now suddenly they have bridged the ancient priesthood. It comes through the great apostasy. Now it's on Joseph. Now the priesthood lineage has been restored.
The priesthood lineage used to be traced through the tribe of Judah. Now they're tracing it through the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh.
And Joseph, and by them to Joseph.
So,
yeah, because that's the birthright. See, Judah would say, yes, it's Judah. But in this setting, it's like, no, it's birthright,
so
son.
Clear down to King David, they were tracing the priesthood lineage, not through Ephraim and Manasseh.
That's right, it's to Judah. Yeah, but we understand that it's about birthright. That's why it had to be Joseph. Okay, all right. So now Joseph as he's sitting there, Joseph is the recipient of the lineage, and he's and now he has the priesthood. It's all got to go through Joseph. Okay, we got it? Okay, he's the bridge. Okay, so the understanding then of this dual heirship that was going to get you to the celestial kingdom was that it was, but listen to how some of our understanding, this is why I think this is important to understand even how we frame the gospel today. Look at the places where this kind of shows up. How about patriarchal blessings? Part of a patriarchal blessing is not just to find out what's going to happen in your life, but also what do you want to know? Your lineage, your tribe. Why is that important? Right, and we kind of say it's nice to know what tribe, and a lot of times patriarchs will say it just tells you what your job is. You're assigned within that tribe to get stuff done. Yeah. But when patriarchal blessings were first initiated, why you need to get your lineage from your patriarchal blessing is why?
Well, people wanted to know they were from the tribe of Ephraim.
It's not about just knowing. Yeah, it's the heirship. You got to know that you are now connected to the tribes of Israel. It is, and that's right. Because if we go back to, and Joseph taught this, that if I'm, let's say that if I baptize Charlie, and it turns out he's one of these tribes, and I give him the gift of the Holy Ghost, now that's going to be a blessing to him, and it guides him forward. But what if I baptize Charlie, and Charlie is not a member of the tribe of Israel? Let's say he's from Ghana. And back then, their understanding, the way they framed it, was what happens when I give him the gift of the Holy Ghost?
Well, your DNA changes.
Yes.
Your blood changes.
Oh, my gosh. They really taught that?
Yes.
Joseph taught that.
He did. He taught it will change his lineage at that moment. That the Holy Ghost changes it. So that's why I say when you're doing literalism, you've got to put the pieces together and...
Ordain them.
Well, not ordain them. Wrong word. I'm going to confer the gift of the Holy Ghost on him after baptism. He was either of the tribe of Israel and he's fine, or he's not of the tribe of Israel and now his lineage has changed.
Well, the way that I have seen it was that their DNA would change over time. It wasn't.
Well, then everybody's got to kind of explain it, but I know.
Okay, and if they were black,
hold on to that. Okay. Hold on to that. Hold on to that. That's in here.
You know, I've also heard, you know, that the lineage, you're a receiver of the blessing that Jacob gave that particular son.
Right. But again, if you were not part of that tribe to begin with,
right.
Now you are, and you're going to be assigned to a kingdom, whether it was Judah or Ephraim or something like that.
Almost all the patriarchal blessings back then were Ephraim.
Well, sure they are, and still are.
And
unless you're in Russia.
Most of them still are.
I know.
But a lot of them say adopted into.
Yeah, but because the idea is that the heirship, you got to be family to get the inheritance. And the patriarchal blessing says, I got it. Okay, now here's the next one. Now, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, again, most of this stuff that we're talking about has some traces to where we are now, but most of this we understand that this was a thinking back then. It's not necessarily thinking.
It was a misunderstanding.
It was a misunderstanding that needed more light and knowledge. It's just fun. Okay, so the other one, if, you know, when my dad ordained me to the Melchizedek priesthood, and I got that, the next thing you generally got was a copy of your lineage, your priesthood lineage, because you've got, so on one side I've got my patriarchal blessing, but I also have to have my priesthood lineage that delineates where I got it from.
You can still write in to the spot where you got it from.
I know.
You don't have to write in. You can just open it on tools.
Yeah, yeah. So Tom had his.
Yeah.
He was ordained Melchizedek. It wasn't his father. So it changed. Yeah.
Ah. That, you know, okay.
And I thought, it changed?
Yeah. But see, but back then it was important that you trace that. Here's the heir, here's the genealogy, here's the priesthood. That makes sense? That's why it was so important.
I learned this just in the last couple of weeks. Blessing ordination of a grandson.
Yeah.
And while we were there, we talked about the priesthood of line of authority. And I ordained my son. So we're looking at our life, our lineage, and it's different. And now I got on the tools, went through the priesthood lineage, and if you had different offices in the priesthood, you're going to have different lineages. And it actually shows that I have two patriarchal or priesthood lineages.
Well, one high priest and one Melchizedek priesthood. Yeah, I've got that same thing.
I ordained this guy an elder through my lineage when I was ordained an elder, even though I was a high priest when I
did. Yeah. And see, at the end of the day, it's just important we got ordained, right? But again, back then it was important that you track it. Because in that literalism, what happens if you break a link? You're lost. That's the problem. Literalism says, okay, hold on, here we go. Okay, so this is some of the foundation behind the believing blood doctrine, that as a missionary in England, my job is to go out and find scattered Israel. And literally was being told and taught that if I'm knocking on doors and they go, nope,
they're not Israel.
Nope, they're not Israel. Nope, nope, come on in, Israel. So in other words, you just knock on as many doors as possible to find Israel, because they're scattered, and if they're not responding, then they're not Israel. They don't have the believing blood.
Okay, this is absolutely fascinating. Like I said, we like to listen to the rest of history, and they say, do not put your current understanding.
That's absolutely. Understanding yes,
blood.
Yes.
Because I remember hearing the word believing blood. What did I think? I just meant it was a faithful person who was ready to believe. I had no idea, but that's mine.
I know, but back then it was a thing.
Well, and how did that work for people then when they fell away? Did their DNA change again?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, now you're an Israelite who just left. Well, that's
Catholic
a bigger.
Catholic Church just went through this about 5 years ago. They had a priest, and somehow they figured out that when he was baptized, they used we baptize you instead of I baptize you. And so they said, well, I know he was a priest and he baptized thousands of people and married thousands of people, but he actually wasn't a member of the church because they said the word
because it said wrong.
They baptized him, and they were having just a
it's a problem when we go that literal. Okay, now there's one other problem that where this plays a role, and that is, it's in the partial justification for the racial thing, okay? Because all of those descendants are now Cain, so they carry that stain, Cain stain, down through the lineage, so we're not going to, so that is part of the justification that says we can't ordain them. But that comes after Joseph Smith already was. but they're guessing. We're trying to hang stuff on here. Yeah. Everything. Big time. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a symbolic. We understand where we got the priesthood from, but the main of the priesthood is about blessing lives, not about saying.
What we need to take literal about lineage is that we are sons and daughters of God.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're born that way. Okay. All right. Now, one last thing, and I'm actually not even getting into the second endowment, so I'm not touching that at the moment. This is a separate deal, and I don't want to spend too long on it, but I just need you to know that there was at the time a third ceiling, and that was this ceiling welding link with the altar as an anvil. It was kind of almost built like an anvil, okay, where we're gonna create heaven right on earth, and what that meant was the thinking was that being sealed to their fathers within the church, the saints would seal their forefather to who? Everything had to then go back to Joseph Smith because he's the guy that holds the whole thing. So even if I have a great genealogy, I'm doing all these things, eventually there has to be an additional ceiling. And that altar in 1846 was dedicated in the Nauvoo Temple by Brigham and Wilford.
Part of that isn't
priestcraft? No. The thinking of the time is that they would be sealed to Joseph Smith by adoption, but I'm trying to save our bacon, okay? Because in doing so would connect the families on earth to the eternal priesthood chain through Joseph's priesthood fathers back to Adam. So that means that ultimately there will be one last sealing. There was a third sealing thing where they'd be sealed kids to parents, parents to another, or to ancestors, and then ancestors to Joseph. That, because if we don't do that, we're lost in space. It's just that's that literal way of looking at the world. Okay, all right. So, we got a few minutes. So let me just get to this. By 1894, there's just this growing unease that just doesn't feel right. We're doing this stuff. We've been doing it for a variety of reasons. It's not feeling good. For a variety of reasons. One, it was missing a fundamental purpose. As President Woodruff explained, the sealing ordinance is ultimately meant to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. Right? But the focus on sealing to church leaders rather than direct ancestors didn't realize this vision. Now I'm not trying. Now I'm less worried. You might be my dad, but I'm not sure how worthy you are. I'd rather be sealed to Brigham Young because I know he's good. So I'm gonna.
Try to take down my family can be together forever.
Yeah, prophets can be together forever. Yeah. So that was just this sense of we're working on fathers to some, but
when everybody gets sealed to Abraham.
Right. Well, exactly.
Why go to Joseph?
But well, because he's right there, so you can do to Joseph, and Joseph is connected to Abraham.
Isn't that what we're doing in the temple, actually being sealed into the covenant of Abraham?
Yeah, you're receiving all the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yes. Yeah.
But it used to be the covenant of Adam and Noah.
Yeah. Okay, so it was a confusion and incomplete process. Many leaders of the church, including Brigham Young, felt the practice was incomplete and needed more revealed on the topic. Their hearts were telling them this isn't accurate, even though we've been doing it for 50 years. They were not satisfied with the tribal sealing, system of sealing, that was the correct order, okay? And there was a growing number of temple-worthy members. When the temples were first built, few members had temple-worthy Latter-day Saint ancestors. By the 1890s, more generations had passed away, meaning they had direct ancestors, which means my father and my grandfather were worthy. Why would I be sealed to Wilford Woodruff if my family now, I can be assured that they were righteous. If my family was not a member, then I don't want to be sealed to them because if they don't accept the gospel in the next life, I'm toast. My exaltation is gone. I got sealed to the wrong person. And especially until the St. George Temple was built, they had just done endowments for the living. So we weren't doing the dead stuff until we got to 1877. So in this 1894 address, and it's pretty landmark, this thing, in conference, he says, this is quoting him, in the commencement of adopting men and women in the temple at Nauvoo, a great many persons were adopted to different men who were not of the lineage of their fathers. And there was a spirit, someone mentioned this, there was a spirit manifested by some in that work that was not of God. Really? Men would go out and electioneer and labor with all their power to get men adopted to them, because men were being sealed to men. Okay, that's how this works. Okay? Yes. Yeah, I'm building kingdoms. It's kingdom building. And you just see when it goes sideways like this, then you're going to start getting all of that. It's like, you know, for whatever plural marriage was or wasn't, then it devolves to the fact that guys are going on missions and bringing three wives back with them. It just kind of goes south.
Is that why we're not supposed to get married on a mission?
I think that's it, yeah. Oh, thousands. 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 Okay? So he's going to give in this talk, he actually gives an example. One instance I'll name here. A man went around Nauvoo asking every man he could, saying, "You come and be adopted to me, and I shall stand at the head of the kingdom, and you will be there with me." Then he says, "Now, what is the truth about this? Those who are adopted to that man, if they go with him, will have to go where he is." He was a participator in that horrible scene, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I mean, you hitched your wagon to the wrong star. If you don't change this, he's dragging you to hell with him. You know, you chose the wrong horse.
No, I would give most of those folks the benefit of the doubt if they were trying to do the best they could.
I think they were.
However, it points to the fact that we need a prophet to guide us and give us those course corrections and adjustments.
Yeah, and a revelation to clean it up. I had a hand over here. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
And I sense that maybe there's less of a stuckness in that understanding of what
kind of a priestcraft.
Right, but it's, yeah. It's in their defense. Again, their understanding back then is what a church was.
And you think about it, in so many cases they had been, like someone said that in like in 1855 or 1860, if you walked down a street in Salt Lake, you'd hear a British accent more than you'd hear American accent. Because that they were coming from Europe in droves, and this was their history, this was their culture, this is what they knew, that's what they brought into the church with them. Okay, yeah. Okay, all right. So part of that talk, perhaps I ought not enter into such things, but it came to me, men are in danger sometimes of being adopted to others until they know who they are and what they will be. Don't want to get sealed to the wrong guy. What are the feelings of Israel? They have felt that they wanted to be adopted to somebody. Okay? They want to be adopted to somebody. Brigham Young was not satisfied in his mind with regard to the extent of this matter. President Taylor was not. When I went before the Lord to know who I should be adopted to, we were being adopted to prophets and apostles. The Spirit of the Lord said to me, "Have you not a father who begot you?" "Well, yes, I have." "Then why not honor him? Why not be adopted to him?" "Yes," I said, "that is right. And I was adopted to my father and should have had my father sealed to his father and so back." Okay? Now, I've mentioned in here before that when I've done the genealogy for Arza Hinckley, my pioneer grandfather, when that St. George Temple was dedicated, he went down to St. George and he had a number of women sealed to him. And he had three wives, but he also had five other women sealed to him. And it took me a little bit of research to realize that was his grandmother's. He had his mother, his grandmother, his great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother. He had these five sealed to him as well. He was saving them. They were being sealed to him. He didn't expect he'd be married to them in the eternities, but they had to come through a priesthood lineage, especially those that had never joined the church. His mother Lois never did, but... and his father didn't either. Okay, so
this is the same year that the Utah Genealogical Society.
Oh, is that right? That's perfect, because that's where he's going to go next on this. Okay. So one other problem I'll throw in here. In the past, widows had been told they could not be sealed because they were being married to non-member guys. Okay. You don't want to hitch your star to a. Okay. So what do any of us know with regard to him, the man that died? Will he not hear the gospel and embrace it in the spirit world? This is the duty that rests upon all Israel, that they shall attend to this work as far as they have the opportunity to do it. In Wilford's view, what was required of the saints? The knowledge that all the temple ordinances would be eventually performed for all of God's children changed the saints' perspective on the perceived need to be sealed to one of the leaders of the church instead of their own fathers and mothers. Okay? What he was saying, Wilford reassured them, there will be very few, if any, who will not accept the gospel. So don't worry about being hitched to the wrong guy. Be sealed to your family, because they will accept the gospel in the next life. I don't. I suspect it happened. Again, I was just talking about Arza. I know that just even recently, I still see him. People are being baptized for him and sealed for him, even though he did it in Nauvoo. He was sealed to his parents in Nauvoo, and they're still getting it done. So even sometimes even by accident, we're still getting it right. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Absolutely. That's why I think it's, even though it's painful sometimes to walk through some of this and see what they believe, I think it's incredibly helpful to say, this is how things evolved over time, and what they believed in 1850 isn't necessarily what they knew in 1870 and then 1910. But I think also for us, I think what's incumbent upon us is, and what's coming 10 years from now? What's coming 20 years from now is further light and knowledge. Are we going to be screaming the fact that that's what we didn't do in 2000? We weren't doing that in 2025. Well, we got further light and knowledge, and we moved the ball as we got further light and knowledge, and we're less amenable to saying, yeah, but Brigham Young said that in 1850. So that's what the church believes. And no, we need to allow the church to progress and grow with greater light and knowledge. Yeah. Yeah. I think the idea was, like with saints, to, at least with that initial part, they're trying to be more apparent, transparent. I agree with you. And especially as we get into some of this. Well, yeah, that's why, for instance, the two great books that have come out on the priesthood ban, Second Class Saints and what's the other one? Anyway, both of them had full access to all the records of the church, with the church's blessing to say, let's tell the real story about what happened. We've got to be completely transparent.
I'm sure that we can look at this and suggest that the way they did things was wrong. Temples is, you know, one of our main purposes here, to provide that funnel that they're
Wrong's the wrong word, isn't it?
It doesn't seem like the Lord would allow us to flounder for, you know, 20, 30 years doing the wrong thing. I think maybe some of these things were the right thing for different circumstances, you know, to get the work done at that point in time. But now
I think so.
There are better ways to do it based on.
Well said.
So it wasn't perfect, and now it's just imperfect.
It wasn't complete, but the work got done. Maybe if it was an incomplete understanding of what it is that they were doing. They were, yeah.
Well, I think maybe God has a more tolerance and a better sense of humor than you think.
All right. Last one here, and then we're done. So basically, here's what he says. And this is quoting from 97, I think. All who have died without a knowledge of this gospel, who have received it if they had been permitted to tarry, shall be heirs in the celestial kingdom. So it will be with your fathers, he says in this address. There will be very few, if any, who will not accept the gospel. The fathers of this people will embrace the gospel. That's what he believed.
So I've been waiting.
Yes?
You implied that the current our understanding of being adopted into the baptized, that that is different now. So what is the current?
The baptism is, as we understand it, is, you know, that it progresses as baptism into the kingdom. I like to use the Book of Mormon practice of, you know, are you willing to suffer with those that suffer more? And so you're coming into a thing. And then, you know, I think it's less about remission of sins, though that's there, but it's more about entering the kingdom, but not because that makes me an heir all the way back where. Yeah, that you'll hear that. That's what I think you'll hear the language. I just think we frame it different now than they framed it different back then. Does that make sense? It was language we use.
Back in Paul's day, when the gospel was expanded.
Oh yeah, the Greeks and Romans and. I don't think he used the word adopted, but what he is saying is that they are. I guess in a sense it would be adopted, right? Because he was saying to a slave, to a Roman citizen, you now have access to all the blessings of Abraham that you just thought the Jews had. You're going to be, so in a sense, heirs, yeah. So, it's there. I think it's in a spiritual sense, but not necessarily in the change your lineage, physical, genealogical sense, if that makes sense. I think it is, but it's a spiritual adoption, not a physical.
Our modern understanding, like for instance, when a new prophet is chosen, you don't think, oh, what was his name?
That's right.
When you get a new leader of a country, you don't think of leaders. A fresh face from anybody.
And spiritually, they're going to be endowed with. To a physical lineage. No, I think that's true.
That went away with the vision where the animals, the clean animals, dirty animals.
Yeah, anything becomes clean, yeah.
Primarily as revealed to Moses in the house of Israel, if we have scriptures, they were revealed to Noah, Adam. I suspect this perspective might have been a little different.
I think so. Again, if in the long run we allow ourselves to grow with light and knowledge and add to what we already have, then like Rick said, it's not a matter that things were wrong. It's a matter that this is a knowledge to that level. It's incomplete. And now we add something to it, and we see it better. We see it more clearly.
One thing that I would also add is there are a lot of leaders in this world, wonderful, marvelous ideas. I don't have a clue on how to get from where they are to where they are.
Yeah.
And I think one of the brilliant and amazing things in the church is that the Lord is able to guide the prophet so he can help us get from where we are to where we ought to be.
Yeah.
That's one of the miracles.
And prune what needs to be pruned and alter what needs to be altered based on incomplete understandings. And then we move forward. Yeah. So, all right. That's a lot. You guys done good. A lot here. Well, what we'll do, like I say, next week, we're going to go after the other one that Wilford Woodruff was having to deal with. And that was the manifesto on plural marriage. And these are a little bit tied to another. To each other, but they're not, because it's two separate issues. So I bury my testimony again that we are blessed to live in a church that has deep roots and amazing traditions. And at the same time, we're also believing a church that progresses and grows over time with new information and new life, knowledge. Yeah, see? That's probably where I should have gone next. If we'd had another half hour, it would probably be that the Lord could have given Brigham Young a revelation in, you know, 1846 and never gone to adoption, but he didn't. He let the church leaders wrestle with it over the years and come to it as they were ready. That would be the next chapter to this. Why doesn't that the Lord doesn't intervene even if a leader has an incomplete understanding? That they're asking at that time. That's right. Yeah. Okay, last one, then I'll let you ask the question, and then I'll let you say the closing prayer, and we'll be out of here.
Well, I was just thinking,
he does. No, we hate uncertainty.
Constant religions are always going, do you know you're saved?
Yeah.
And we don't pronounce it that way.
Yeah.
That they do.
Even though we believe we are.
Everything seems to be up and down, just like a coastline. And we try to fill in all those little gaps.
Yeah.
For our own feeling of ease.
Yeah.
Rather than, we're trying to make an answer fit so that this peak over here reaches this peak over here.
I think that's a great way to put it.
And it doesn't mean the Lord can't come back and say, oh, okay, you're getting way off track. So he takes us further.
Cool.
But he lets us struggle with it.
True. All right. Now, can you give us our closing prayer and we're out of here?
Sorry.
Oh, you're right.
I was on another hill.
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.